For this first coffee club after a 2 weeks break because of holidays in France and because of workshop on SKA and the precursors hosted the plan actually virtually. Today we have Robert Lillo, who is postdoc at Haifa, Technion Haifa, Israel, working with Adi. I'm not sure about the right pronunciation of the family name.
It's Nasa.
Nasa.
Okay. So he deliberately used the U because it's typically pronounced Nasa in English-speaking countries, but yeah.
Okay. Before Robert, his first postdoc since a couple of years. He graduated in 2018 at Heidelberg, working with Matthias Bartemann on kinetic field theory, the one of the last emerging theory analytical theories to investigate this growth of structures. And today, Robert is going to talk about constraint realization related to also peculiar velocity surveys from the two-mass ratio survey. Please.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the invitation and introduction. So yeah, as Carlos said, I want to talk about today how you can generate and use constraint realizations of density, but specifically peculiar velocity fields from a two-mass redshift survey to probe the growth rate of structures. So this is based on this recent archive paper of Adi and me. And let me just start with a very short motivation. So typically, if you want to use investigate structure formation and use it to constrain cosmology, most of the time we're looking at very large scale average statistical quantities, like, of course, most famously meta power spectrum, or you could, of course, also look at bispectral or other higher endpoint functions, or also halo mass function, any kind of statistical quantity to compare with between observation and theory. What I want to talk about today, however, is not really concerned with these statistical properties of the structures, but rather looking at the specific distribution of meta in our local neighborhood. And not only its distribution, but also its flow. This can be used to constrain the growth rate because these local structures that we see, they all have to satisfy the continuity equation, and which in the assumption of linear theory, as I've written it here, becomes just a very simple linear proportionality between the convergence of the velocity, peculiar velocity field, and the meta over density delta, with the proportionality just given by the growth rate f, which then of course can, in lambda CDM, approximately relate to the dimensionless meta density, like so. And so we are mostly concerned with states where this linear theory is a good assumption and makes our life much easier and everything also way more efficient, as you will see in the following steps. Now, of course, we don't directly observe the meta distribution, the density of meta. What we actually observe to be galaxies. So rather than expressing this relation in terms of the meta over density, we use linear bias relation between the meta over density and the one of galaxies here. And what I've done here immediately also is approximating this linear bias factor by the ratio of the sigma 8 fluctuation amplitudes between galaxies and meta. So that overall, it's useful then to define this normalized over density delta hat, just normalized to sigma 8, which basically allows us to absorb all also radial dependencies of this bias introduced by the flux limit that we have. We only see more luminous galaxies further out and only focus on constraining this combination of actual cosmological parameters f and sigma 8. Now, the way that we are doing the constraint here is basically following a two-step procedure. First of all, we use our redshift survey to reconstruct the density and then using this linear relation therefrom the peculiar velocities. Now, of course, this still depends on this parameter. So what we then do in the second step is compare our peculiar velocities with independently directly observed ones from some peculiar velocity or distance survey, and this way get a constraint on f sigma 8. All right, so let me first guide you a bit through the main steps of how the method we use works to do the reconstruction. The input that we're using, as mentioned in the beginning, is 2MRS, the 2 Mars Redshift Survey. That's the densest all-sky redshift survey we have to date. Contains approximately 45,000 galaxies with an effective depth of roughly 0.05 in redshift. So it is rather shallow, but it has these very two crucial properties. It's all-sky in the sense of, as you can see down here, all-sky except for just a thin slice around the galactic disk and bulge. So we can essentially, with some little, refilling of this disk, assume statistical isotropy, which will become very crucial. And secondly, it also has a very well-defined flux limit. So in the KS band, it's 100% complete up to a magnitude of 11.75. So that is all enough for us to get a reconstruction out to approximately 200 megaparsec over H distance. Right. Now, the methods we're using to do the reconstruction and then generate these constraint realizations, basically a combination of different pre-existing methods, extending them partially and combining them in new ways to account for longer sanity in the field space of the day. So first of all, we of course have to give credit to the fact that we observe stuff in redshift space, redshift space S, and we're interested in the real space quantity. So of course, these two redshift space and real space coordinates are related by the along the line of sight peculiar velocity of the galaxies we're observing. And to be in line with the linear theory assumption we're doing, we correct for these redshift space distortions also on the linear level, essentially by linear Taylor expansion in this peculiar velocity. Now, of course, to do this, we already would have to know the velocities, but that's the neat thing about using it also on the linear level is that we can invert this relation self-consistently in one step efficiently, rather than having to do some iterative process to get to the real space distribution. Now, of course, just getting to real space is not enough. Our observations are also noisy. We're not directly observing the smooth density field, but rather have a discrete set of galaxies tracing that density. So we have short noise. Now, the way that we address the short noise is by applying a well-known Wiener filter. And just in a nutshell, the Wiener filter, what it does is it multiplies the data that you observe with the inverse of the data-data covariance, multiplies it afterwards with the cross-covariance between the signal you're interested in and the data. So we can see whenever you have regions in your data space that are have a very high signal to noise, so where the data basically is the signal, the Wiener filter approaches unity and then leaves the data in those regions mostly untouched. Whereas if you have regions which are more noise dominated, this inverse data-data covariance suppresses the data in these regions. So in that sense, by suppressing the noisy regions, it is a conservative estimator. If signal and data would follow Gaussian statistics, it would also agree with just the mean estimator of that field. Now, of course, that's not the case today. Nowadays, structures we observe, are first order approximated by more like a log normal distribution, and then galaxies, of course, follow up something like a Poisson sampling thereof. So Gaussianity doesn't hold, but this conservative property is preserved regardless of the underlying probability distribution. And another property that also is independent from that is that the Wiener filter always minimizes the variance between the reconstructed fields and the true one. So that's the property we are focusing most on, so why we can still use the Wiener filter in that nonlinear setting, well, non-Gaussian setting. Then, all right, so I deliberately phrased signal data here in a more abstract fashion, because in principle you have still some freedom of choice in which space you're operating. So which space you actually define your densities that you're interested in, and then the Wiener filter. The most obvious one would be just to work with a density like on a 3D spatial grid, but that makes inversion pretty expensive and numerically unstable. So often, of course, you exploit the statistical isotropy and homogeneity of your cosmic fields and go to Fourier space. But while we have statistical isotropy in a survey such as 2MRS, we of course don't have homogeneity because it's a flux limited survey. So you observe fewer and fewer galaxies when going to larger distances, as shown in this redshift distribution of 2MRS here. So the short noise contribution increases with radius. And of course, you also have coupling of radial modes due to the redshift space distortion. So going to freerun space doesn't make your life easier. But what we use here is basically the space that is maximally diagonal, giving still the isotropy that we have, which is spherical Fourier Bessel space. So essentially you expand the density you're interested in and also the velocity then in spherical harmonics as well as spherical Bessel functions. And then this is a nice advantage that all the angular modes are completely decoupled. And we only have to worry about the coupling between radial modes and only invert a radial part of this matrix, so to speak. That makes the whole thing way more efficient and maybe even more importantly, more scalable. So because the complexity of this method then doesn't scale with the volume as it would be in a real space reconstruction, but only with the depth, the radial distance in your survey. Right. Now, of course, as I said, the Wiener filter is a conservative estimator in the sense of suppressing noisy region, but by doing so, it also suppresses the signal in those regions. So we would like to reinstate the thing that we're suppressing statistically, but we also would like to have a reliable error estimate of these reconstructions. And both of these issues can be addressed by the concept of constraint realizations. Now, the idea of constraint realization is basically just instead of looking at just one estimator of your fields, whatever it might be, you generate a whole ensemble of all reconstructions that are viable realizations given the noisy data that you observe. And this way they reinstate the uncertainty at you, the statistics you have in your field, and also account for all the correlation in that noise that you can then subsequently exploit when doing statistical inference from these set of reconstructed realizations. Now, the way we follow here is the method introduced by Hoffmann-Rybak, where essentially you say, I start with generating some random realization of my signal, given its underlying probability distribution. I generate an associated realization of the data, apply my filter, my estimator to the data, look then at the residual, and this quantity essentially describes my correlated noise contribution, and then simply add this to the Wiener filter estimate of the actual data. And repeating this for a set of random realizations, I generate an ensemble of constraint realizations. Similar to properties of Wiener filter, this thing is only exact in the sense of truly sampling from the full conditional probability distribution given these observational constraints if the statistics are Gaussian. As mentioned, that's not the case. However, for our purposes, it's fine to still apply this. First of all, we account for the non-Gaussianity in our data in the way that we generate these random signals and data by sampling random data from log normal distribution and then afterwards doing a Poisson sampling to get some mock set of galaxies, or some random set of galaxies. And the second thing is that while this does not exactly sample the full log normal Poisson constraint PDF, it still is constrained by construction on the level of the variance. And also by construction, you can see that the scatter between these constraint realizations and our average Wiener filter estimate is exactly the same as the scatter between the underlying signal and the Wiener filter estimate. So this is the property we're way more interested in. Right. And down here, you see an example of that. So on the left, you see the Wiener filter result that you get for the actual data from 2MS using the methods outlined before. This is shown as a slice through the supergalactic plane here, where the heat maps and the contours show this normalized overdensity introduced before, and the arrows show a peculiar velocity flow field. And if you compare those observations, you can actually neatly identify known structures. So we are in the center here, just above Virgo. Coma, for example, would be up here. And the most dominant structure in this volume is the Shapley supercluster over here. So to get one constraint realization, you would have to add to this now a realization of this correlated noise. And this is just one example as shown here on the right. Can clearly see because we're sampling this from log norm distribution, there is structure in this noise. It's not just completely random. And the overall amplitude is, you can see for density contrast, typically of the order of below one. For the velocities, typically of the order of 100 kilometers per second or lower. But of course, you can already see here, given that our shot noise increases with radius, due to the flux limit we have. Also, these correlated noise contribution that we have to add to the Wiener filter also increase with radius. And we can make this statement more quantitative by looking just at the variance, the scatter of this noise between a set of constraint realizations. In this case, just took 50 constraint realizations, looked, averaged the scatter between those in blue in the density and orange the velocity, and also exploited the isotropy and only showed as a function of radius here. Now, the whole thing here is not an absolute numbers, but rather normalized to the respective cosmic variances of these fields. So one essentially means we haven't learned anything in our reconstructions. We basically are on the cosmic variance noise level. Anything below that is some information gain, some reconstruction. As you can see on the nearby the center, we actually get a really small noise, small scatter only. We really can construct the fields on the level of 20% of the cosmic variance, but then this slowly gets closer and closer to cosmic variance as we approach the boundary. So basically at 200, you're mostly cosmic variance. So basically within 100 megaparsec is where you have the strongest constraints. So this is how we get our reconstructed densities and using the linear theory assumption from them, the velocities. But as said in the beginning, this still depends on the value of F sigma 8 of this normalized growth rate. So now the second step come in to constrain that is to use an independent set of directly observed peculiar velocities. So the data set that we are using is the Cosmic Flows 3 catalog, which is a very large compilation of galaxy distances, which have been obtained using various methods of various heuristic methods. Most dominantly Tully Fisher and fundamental plane relations, but of course, whenever available, also a type 1a supernovae and many more methods. It contains roughly 18,000 galaxies, which are distributed over 11,500 galaxy groups. And actually all analysis that we will do will only concern these group average quantities to already exploit that if we group average all the quantities within a group, we get rid of most of these very small scale nonlinear velocity contributions like virial motions of galaxies within a cluster that of course our linear theory assumption wouldn't account for. You can see here a visualization of the distribution of these galaxies again in the supergalactic plane cut. The color code mean different input surveys. We can clearly see, unlike 2MS, there is no statistical isotropy in this compilation. It basically gathers everything available, but that's not a problem for us here anymore because once we have our reconstructions, we do the comparison on a point-by-point level without having any isotropy requirement. Now, to the comparison, to compare the velocities observed, or it can be inferred from these observed distances and redshifts with our reconstruction, we have to account for one more thing, namely that our reconstruction, of course, only contains the observed structures within the 2MS volume. However, the velocities within this volume are also experiencing the gravitational interactions from sources beyond that volume. So there are additional contributions to the velocity that we can't get from 2MS. So what we do here is a simple modeling of saying there is an additional external contribution that we just approximate as a global bulk flow that we add onto our constraint realizations. And while estimating the growth rate F sigma 8, we leave this external contribution as an additional free parameter. Thirdly, we also leave the Hubble constant that is used to compute the absolute distance to these objects in CF3 also as a free parameter. So essentially, this is kind of rescaling of these distances accounting for the Hubble flow. However, should keep in mind for our purposes, this is just a nuisance parameter. This method is not really designed to accurately constrain H0, but I can tell you already that in the end, when we do this, we find a value that is consistent with what was found just from cosmic flows itself. So that's fine. Then the actual comparison is not really done directly on the level of velocities, but rather we do it on the level of the log distances mu. The reason is that this is the quantity that is directly constrained by these distance catalogs, these distance surveys, and also has, to good approximation, Gaussian errors. So what we do is I look at this residual of these observed log distances in CF3 and compare those to the expected distances, which we get from the observed redshift corrected for our reconstructed peculiar velocity. And here explicitly write out again that these depend on f sigma 8 and of course this external contribution. So and then afterwards, given one specific constraint realization of the velocities, we just do a chi-square minimization of this to get the best values for these three parameters. And then to account for the uncertainty and correlations we have between possible realizations of the velocities, we repeat this process for a whole set of constraint realizations. And then the final error estimate is given by the average over those. And the error is then a basic combination of two contributions. We just have the scatter between these best fit values between different constraint realizations. This essentially accounts for our 2MS shot noise contribution to the uncertainty. And the second contribution is just the average error from your chi-square fit per realization. So which basically accounts for the uncertainty in these observed log distances. So we can neatly separate those two contributions. Now, if you do that exercise, this is what you get. So this is only looking at the result, the marginalized result for f sigma 8 here, where we still leave the smoothing scale that we apply to our reconstruction as a free parameter. And as you can see here, there's a very strong dependence on the smoothing scale, which is well known before. That basically just is a result of comparing the smoothed velocities with point by point unsmoothed observed velocities. So essentially, you have some mixing of modes where if you introduce larger and larger smoothing scales, then essentially the overall amplitude in the reconstruction reduces, which then is overcompensated by this higher value of the growth rate. Now, there are different methods to account for this bias or to get rid of it or to avoid it in the beginning. One thing I want to mention, which is most typically used, is that people found from looking at simulations that at the smoothing scale of roughly 5 megaparsec over h or maybe 4, this value turns out to be very, very close to the unbiased result. And then people typically or often use this value that they found at the smaller end of the scale here for their calculations, which is, in my opinion, a dangerous business because all these approaches typically also keep the same linearity assumption as we do, but 5 megaparsec over h is just below the linearity scale. So you're applying it to a, while it technically might be unbiased there, you're applying a linear assumption to where it doesn't apply, where you rather should focus maybe on this region, like 10 or at least, or maybe 15 megaparsec and larger. And as you will see in a moment, this actually makes a big difference. So the way we're doing it is different. We rather choose to calibrate our results on the whole range of possible smoothing scales. And for that, we go to simulations. So we take the suite of multi-dark simulations, specifically the MDPL2 one is one of these ones using Planck cosmology, and has also the nice property of coming with a very high quality semi-analytic galaxy catalog alongside it. So we use this galaxy catalog to generate realistic mock catalogs representing 2MS and CF3. And realistic means for one, of course, trying to reproduce these survey characteristics as close as possible, but also very importantly, to represent the actual environment that we live in our local group here as closely as possible, because the local group is moving with a rather high velocity in a very coherent flow region. So it's a peculiar environment that we're living in. And to not introduce any additional systematic biases here, we want to reproduce these in our mocks as close as possible. And we have a set of constraints that we use for that. Just basically the main things is we want to have a local group-like group in the middle of our volume, so similar mass. Well, we want the Virgo mass halo in the correct distance to the local group without any other dominant structures nearby. So that's really just the local flow dominated by Virgo as it is in the real universe. And then also match all the absolute as well as relative velocities of these objects and between them, as well as the local bulk for contribution. So really try to represent the local flow structure as close as possible. And using this set of criteria, we find 17 mocks that we can work on. And the calibration that we're doing then is by applying the same pipeline I just described to these mocks, then taking the average of that result dividing our raw estimate by that and multiplying then with the true result for the mocks. And if you do that, you get the difference from the left to the right-hand panel here. So you really see this completely gets rid of this scale-dependent bias, and we're actually on the level, as you would expect, close to what is usually referred to as the unbiased smoothing scale. So that is consistent. Now we can also see that, of course, we introduce extra uncertainty due to the scatter between the mocks, and this is especially increased on these smaller scales. That makes sense because this effectively reflects the limits of our linear model assumptions. So the scatter between reconstructed and true velocity in the mocks will be larger on these scales where our modeling is worse. So this is properly taken into account here, and overall we have a combination of rigorous statistical as well as systematical error estimate this way. And then the final result, we pick at the smoothing scale of 15, just to be on the safe side with regards to linear scales. And this is the result we get, but we just translated it to the linear sigma 8 result, because that is the most common actual cosmological parameter combination and also used in other literatures. We find a value of 0.36 with these different error contributions. We see 2MAS and CF3, very similar. But actually, the largest contribution really is the systematic effect that we estimate from the scatter between mocks. So doing a linear theory reconstruction without accounting for this, as is often done, is definitely underestimating the errors we have. And what I'm doing, showing here, is a big comparison with basically all available nearby constraints on this growth rate. So in the small redshift range here, from various different publications where the color coding represents different methods to be used. So I don't have time to go into details, but all orange, so our value is the one circled here, all orange values use similar method in the sense of they also start with a redshift survey, do a linear theory construction, and compare to some independent peculiar velocity constraints. In that sense, they are the same. And you directly notice there are a few points which have definitely smaller error estimates than we do, but they, in my opinion, directly fall into this trap that I mentioned before. They're using this supposedly unbiased result here where linear theory doesn't apply, don't account for the error contribution that we take into account from our calibration to mocks as well as from constraint realizations. So they definitely underestimate the error budget. If we would do the same and check, we get very comparable errors to them. So that seems consistent. Apart from that, you can see basically we're consistent with our results, and what is shown here as the gray bands are the 1 and 2 sigma confidence levels of Planck 2018. So we're also consistent with those. There's maybe one thing to mention which is quite intriguing, even though individually basically nearly all points are compatible with Planck, they seem to systematically fall under this result. So that would be definitely interesting to explore more detail. However, I have to be careful because there are definitely lots of overlaps between the data sets used here. So a naive average doesn't cut it. And then lastly, I want to mention the results that we find for bulk flow. So first of all, this free parameter for the external bulk flow contribution that we introduced find of an order of 160 kilometers per second. So it's definitely sizable just due to the small size of TrueMAS. And this is compatible with what other people found that were using different methods. Showing the error budget again, but here you can see definitely different contribution because this is just a global dipole flip. Actually, uncertainty from our linear theory assumption is negligible from the estimate from the mocks, and it's mostly dominated just by the uncertainty in the constraint velocity realizations. So the shot noise essentially. And what I show here is then our results for the total bulk flow, by that I mean from the 2MAS internal contribution plus this external one, where our result is the black line, and you see it here as a function of the radius of Gaussian window within this bulk flow is computed, gray band being the 1 sigma error. Compares to different other local measurements of the bulk flow, where colors now don't mean methods, but just same color means same publication, just different radii. And you can see also here with most of the other results, we are consistent at 1 sigma level, with the remaining ones at a 2 sigma level. Still see that seems to be our result a bit lower than all others. It's probably due to the fact that the growth rate values they found or assumed in these publications I'm comparing with is a bit higher than ours. So that translates, of course, also into the bulk flow. But it's still consistent. And also want to mention, if you would go down to a smoothing a radius of zero, so essentially what is our reconstruction for the local group movement, if you would compare that with the observed local group movement with respect to CMB, we not only in amplitude, but also within direction, we completely agree within one sigma. So that is a good consistency check of our results. And with that, I want to come to an end. Let me quickly summarize. So I hope I could show you that you can use constraint realizations based on the Wiener filter from redshift surveys, and specifically TrueMIS in this case, to get both robust reconstructions of density and peculiar velocity fields, but that also provides you with a faithful estimation of the correlated statistical errors that you have. However, at the same time, given some modeling assumption that we have to make, it's important to account for the systematic errors introduced by that by doing high quality calibration of this result on realistic mocks, which I would argue has been definitely not done enough in most past publications on these type of studies. Then by combining our results, our reconstructions with cosmic flows, we get competitive constraints on growth rate and bulk flow with realistic error estimates. And lastly, as a bit of an advertisement, all the code we've written to generate these constraint realizations and do the comparisons, call it Koras, and it's made publicly available in my GitHub account. All the links are in the paper, so feel free to use it to work with it your own or to modify it if you want it. And for easy access, we also make directly the reconstructed fields available alongside if you just want those. Now, as very last, just a short outlook. All I've done so far was all the work we've done so far assumed that the redshifts are exact without any errors, which is fine for the spectroscopic redshifts in 2MS. But if we want to extend this in the future to larger data sets, we also will have to include photometric redshifts. So we plan now to implement photometric redshift errors into the generation of constraint realizations. Another thing we're interested in would be to directly include observed peculiar velocities into the Wiener filtering and CR generation, rather than having to like a posterior comparison with something like cosmic flows. And lastly, I want to mention that, of course, the most interesting future application will be spherics, because that's the next big all-sky survey, with much larger data volume, 500 million galaxies, approximately up to very high redshifts. So this is really where the very efficient scalability of algorithm will help in making this endeavor feasible. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert, for this very clear talk. I have some questions, but not for the other people. You have any question? Any question or comment? In the chat. You have a question? Please, Elena, go ahead first.
Thank you for the nice talk. Yes, for very interesting work. So I have a few questions about your calibration technique that you mentioned before. So if I understood correctly, you calibrate the amplitude of your velocities against mocks. Is this correct?
So the calibration we're doing here is actually not on the level directly of the velocities, but really just for the final estimate of the F sigma 8 parameter combination. So really just throw exactly the same analysis pipeline that we do for the real data on the mocks, and then do the calibration on the level of this parameter. So we don't do an direct calibration on the level of the individual velocities, because that is a bit more tricky, because then we know that for all these mocks, we know they have the same true value of F sigma 8 that we can use for the calibration. Whereas while we basically choose these mocks to represent the local environment, they still have overall different velocity fields. We cannot just easily calibrate the whole velocities in the volume like that.
Okay, because so my the small doubt that I have was concerning the fact that it's a well-known fact also from the old papers of Adi that linear theory tends to systematically overestimate the amplitudes of velocities. So I guess this is like one of the side effects is also to produce a varying value of F sigma 8 as a function of smoothing.
Yep.
So so you need to correct for this overestimation. My concern is like actually linear theory not only systematically overestimates, but also tends to disrupt the correlation between reconstructed and two peculiar velocities. So mm-hmm. I was not sure that the calibration can actually account for this. So this is on top of the noise you're adding. So just for what concerned the linear theory, so also without linear filtering.
No, these are valid points. I mean, basically the fact that you see this mixing of modes and basically affecting this correlation is what introduces this the dependence here. And this is a very simplistic calibration, that is true. It still should account for all these effects you mentioned within the errors we can estimate. So I mean, this overestimation is also accounted for. We get the same effect in our mocks, assuming there are as realistic as we hope. So this is automatically accounted for. There are still limits to that, and we would like to go beyond doing calibration like that. So one thing that you can do to avoid the dependence on these mocks for the calibration is to also smooth the observed velocities directly on the same scale that you observe, that you smooth your reconstruction on. So you really compare apples with apples from begin with. This is something you want to look into in one of the next papers. So do it directly. So you already have a proper estimation without the smoothness scale dependence. And of course, that still compares linear reconstruction with non-linear, just smooth values. That is true. So at the moment, we're mostly relying on the fact that on the sufficiently large scales, the linear theory assumption works well. Of course, you can in principle, and people do that, look into reconstruction doing non-linear dynamics. But you introduce a whole other lot of caveats. So basically, as soon as you get more nonlinear, any kind of slight bias you might have in your modeling, maybe your the PDF you assume for your statistics is not quite right, the way you treat nonlinear bias is not quite right, tends to quickly blow up and basically be misinterpreted. So I mean, there was also a paper by Adi and Kieselmann showing that actually, for realistic situations where you have real redshift space distortions and noise on scales above 5 megaparsec, often linear reconstruction does equally well as nonlinear reconstruction. So there are possibilities to go beyond, but you have to be very careful. And the way we choose is rather to stick to linear theory with these calibrations.
Okay, thank you.
Pleasure.
Maybe it's time for my question. If I don't see any other comment or question meanwhile, so let me go ahead. My question concerning your chi-square minimization. You fit for three parameters, which is two scalar, f sigma 8, the product f sigma 8, yeah. The value of H naught as deduced from the data on CFT and the vector. Okay, the ones on the vector. Okay. Also inspired by a paper today on archive by George F. Statue, to H naught or to not H naught. Actually, he is reminding a known fact concerning supernovae, but it's the same. Whether it is worth adding to these parameters. Also, the parameters that you need to calibrate the distance of measurements in the data set, in this case, a distance of a cosmic flow 3 data. For instance, the parameters to calibrate a Talley-Fisher relation in order to obtain the distance and then infer the velocity. Otherwise, the risk is to bias the final results you get on these three parameters, especially after marginalization on f sigma 8. Are you considering this factor? Do you think that adding these nuisance parameters accounting for calibrations doesn't really modify the results?
I'm not sure. So I haven't thought about doing that yet. That's an interesting point. Yeah, of course. At the moment, we assume just the data as given without, and only basically the only calibration of the data itself is essentially the H naught value here, as you said. I don't have a good situation, I have to say, of how much introducing these extra nuisance parameters might affect the results.
The paper today was about the H naught tension, deduced from supernovae, saying that, well, it's not enough to take into account in a joint analysis the prior on H naught as estimated by, for instance, the show catalog, the union catalog of a supernovae. The final results on the usual cosmological parameters is biased as soon as you do not consider the calibrations of a supernova to see fades and etc.
I haven't
when I see the plot of F sigma 8 as a function of redshift for the different surveys and methods with some scatter, maybe it can be
this is definitely an interesting point. I have to look into this, I have to say. I didn't see that yet. So naively, I would have assumed that this mostly affects H naught, which is in our case on nuisance parameter. But as you said, it explicitly was shown that it also can affect the growth rate, right?
Yeah. Okay. The point is that H naught is deduced from a calibration of other parameters.
Yeah.
So the tension is not in H naught or in the F sigma A that you find with respect to other surveys, but it comes from the calibration, tension in calibration.
No, I think that. Okay, this is something I definitely would try to.
Indeed, Cosmic Flow 3 is a collection of data measured using different
techniques. So, I mean, I'm also trusting on them having like doing the zero point calibration, all of this accurately, which might not be the case, of course. That is true. So, yeah, I guess, I mean, the redshift survey side is usually, I mean, that's kind of the safer side. There's much less systematics kind of going on. The distance catalogs is definitely a tricky thing. This is also, I mean, okay, I have to look into that. It's an interesting point. Thank you for bringing that up. One thing that might also help in a bit reducing the influence on that is by what I mentioned at the very end, that we would like to take pure velocity constraints directly into account in reconstruction. Then, of course, I mean, if you use the same CF3 data, then you have the same problem, just at the shift at a different position. But in principle, you could think about being more selective in the type of data you use there, rather than having like this, because you mostly need it for an anchoring point, first of all, in this reconstruction. So now, of course, what you consider high quality and most reliable peculiar velocity observations, that's another question of debate. So it's not perfectly addressing the question. So I have to look into this, how much this would actually change our results and or the error budget.
Yeah, I think. Thank you. And I have also a technical question, but maybe we can talk about later on this. Any other comment or question? No. So I wish to thank you again, Robert, for your short talk. And remember the people that next week we will have a cafe club by Paolo Serra, astronomer at ENAF Cagliari, who talk about very recent results obtained with the MeerKAT radio telescope. So see you next week, everybody.